PWC Baisha, and then the Life and Touch, and Weber Wenzel Bars, and then, yeah, and then we have those written submissions that I mentioned yesterday. Without wasting time, I'm going to give Bravura 20 minutes to do their presentation. After that, we'll take PWC, and after that, take Saika, and we will then engage with the
summarize the changes and then go through an illustration of the various impacts. That's all on a generic type basis, and then I will highlight a number of the classes of transaction that are negatively impacted by the changes. In terms of the existing Section 45 relief, it's effectively a rollover relief for transfers of assets within a group of companies. A group of companies for these purposes being a 70% common ownership test. The 70% was largely introduced down from 75% to facilitate certain BEE transactions. It does apply currently as a deferral mechanism. Where assets are transferred around a group, there is no tax levied on the transfer at that time. In effect, the recipient company takes over the rolled over base cost of the prior holder, and the transferor is not taxed on the proceeds, irrespective of the sale value, whether the sale is at tax base cost, book value, market value, or anything else. What then happens is when the recipient company disposes, the rolled over gain is triggered. So taxation actually only occurs at the point that the asset leaves the group, i.e. when the group actually realises an economic or real profit. Tax is also only levied once, there is no double taxation. In terms of the proposed changes, before we go to the effect, I think we have to say there was some specific anti-avoidance identified in the media statement. The particular anti-avoidance sidestepped CGT entirely, and we do support the closing of the loophole. I think it's entirely understandable. And there was some existing anti-avoidance in place, but that was able to, parties were able to sidestep that. So what we're looking at now is effectively an extension of existing anti-avoidance to tighten up the legislation. The proposed changes to Section 45 are effectively twofold. Firstly, where sales are settled in cash, the relief will no longer apply. The effect of that is, even though you transfer an asset within the group, so the group hasn't actually realised a real economic gain, they're now going to be taxed on it. So it goes against the principle of the existing Section 45. And I think our view is very much that given that cash is worldwide a commonly used method of settling purchase prices, to disapply the relief across the board merely because cash is used doesn't make sense. It's gone far too wide. The alternative, and the second leg to this, is an avoidance mechanism whereby loan or purchases are funded on loan account. In such cases, the proposed change suggests or indicates that the loan that you receive for the asset will also take on the rolled over base cost. Now, the issue that we have with that is it results in double taxation. The recipient company will pay tax when they dispose of the asset, but when they then repay the loan, the original transferor is going to pay tax on exactly the same amount. So where the group has ultimately sold an asset, it's realised one economic gain, it's going to be taxed on that amount twice. That's not something uncommon in the rollover release. Other sections have this doubling up as well, but in the other sections there is a means of mitigating it, whereas in this instance that doesn't exist. You see at the bottom there, we said effectively it kills intergroup transactions as it currently stands. So just to highlight, where you see at the end of a section a reference, for example, to para 2.1, that's a cross-reference to our full written submissions that you received earlier. So the slides are effectively a summary of the full narrative that was provided previously. As I say, I think before we go into the detail, I think just in summary, I think the issue we have here is that this is an avoidance measure gone too far. Rather than taking a rifle to shoot the wolf amongst the sheep, we've lain down poison, and the poison killed all the sheep at the same time. I'm just going to go through quickly the impact on the two types of transactions. Firstly, the illustration of what the exclusion of cash transactions means. If we take a simple example, under the current Section 45, we have a group of companies there. Subco 1 sells an asset to Subco 2 with a base cost of 20 and a market value of 100. It sells it across for 100. We have no gain taxed in Subco 1. There's a rollover there. And then Subco 2 takes the rollover base cost. So Subco 2 now holds an asset worth 100 and a base cost of 20. When Subco 2 sells the asset, it then is taxed on the gain of 80. And that's entirely the principle behind it and wholly acceptable. Where we move to under the proposed changes are that the sale is still is effectively precluded from relief under Section 45. Because we're using cash, Subco 1 will now pay tax on the gain of 80 to Subco 2, notwithstanding that the asset remains within the group and there's been no cash out. And cash out is the critical phrase here from the anti-avoidance. Now, the other aspect is that the media statement released in this regard said that there are alternative reliefs that can be used. Or, in fact, the section still allows for a transfer for no consideration. Then you'd still get the relief. The problem with that is, if we do a transfer for no consideration, the minute that there are minorities involved, either in Subco 1 or Subco 2, commercially that won't fly. If there's a minority interest in Subco 1, any transfer for no consideration to Subco 2 will prejudice the minorities in Subco 1, and indeed any creditors of Subco 1. If there are minorities in Subco 2, then effectively the Holdco group has given away value to the minorities of Subco group and of Subco 2 and prejudiced the entire group. The other relief that's referred to as being available is we can still use what's called Section 42 relief, which is a transfer against shares. But again, that's undesirable because we end up with a messy group structure with cross-holdings of shares, and again, where there are minorities, we're either diluting existing minorities or giving someone an undue advantage. So the impact of this conclusion, the impact of exclusion of cash is the group still retains the asset, there's been no cash out, but effectively we're accelerating tax, which is against the underlying principle. The second leg that I mentioned was the issue of double taxation. But I'd like to take a second just to illustrate the cascading effect of CGT prior to going through how this applies in the revised Section 45, just to cast it in the understanding light. If we take an existing structure here, Holdco with an intermediate company, Midco, and then a sub, the base cost for tax in each instance, Holdco has a base cost of 20 in Midco, who has a base cost of 20 in sub. But sub and therefore Midco are both worth 100. If Midco sells sub for 100 and then parent sells Midco for 100, we actually get gain of 80 plus 80. Although the real cash that ends up in Holdco is only 81. Now that's the cascading effect of CGT, and it's a feature where you have different companies within the group. Why that isn't really a concern is it's relatively easy to structure around that to achieve the true aim, which is what would happen is Midco would first sell Subco for 100 and would be taxed on the gain. So the group has now been taxed on the gain of 80, that's fine. Midco then uses that fund to pay a dividend up to the parent company. Midco then decreases in value to 20 and can be sold for 20. The group has received its 100 of cash, but has only been taxed on a gain of 80. And that is the true tenor of the transaction. The group has made a gain of 80 and has been taxed on it once. There is an alternative. There are a number of alternatives. I've just put up another one as by way of illustration, just to show that the legislation specifically provides that you can get to this single economic gain, single tax, and we can use a liquidation relief to achieve the same effect. What our problem is that's all well and good for these type of transactions. The proposed change to Section 45 gives us a cascade effect, which I'll illustrate in a second, but no means of mitigating it. So Under the existing legislation, again, going back to the original example of sub 1 and sub 2, where now we don't do it for cash, but sub 2 buys the asset from sub 1 on loan account. Initially, we will qualify for rollover relief, so that's fine. Sub 2 takes over our sub 1's base cost of 20 in the asset. On a subsequent sale by sub 2, sub 2 will be taxed on the gain of 80. Again, we have no issue with that. That's the point. When it leaves the group, you're taxed. However, when sub 2 then repays the loan account to sub 1, sub 1 is going to be taxed on 80 again. Now, that is unacceptable. I mean, that's what I've described the position now under proposed changes. Again, the media statement refers to that there are other ways of doing this that can sidestep the problem. The key one there is a sale undervalue, so that sub 1 would sell to sub 2 not at 100, but at the tax base cost of 20. Therefore, repayment of the loan wouldn't give a second level of tax. Fair enough, again, until you come to the point where minorities are involved. The minute a minority is involved in either sub 1 or sub 2, a sale undervalue prejudices one set of shareholders or creditors. And the other aspect with sales undervalue is, in concept it's fine, and some of these transactions do actually happen, but you always have to have a mindset towards making sure that your solvency requirements are met. We've now identified a number of classes of transactions. We'll go through those in more detail in the full written submission. I will just quickly highlight them and focus in on a number of those. BEE transactions, which fall into two categories, both internally and externally funded. And I think here the very real concern is we're not just talking about BEE transactions, we're talking about the move and the focus on broad-based BEE transactions. I'll deal with that in a second. The securitization transactions, whereby companies look to raise cheaper financing, are negatively impacted. And then straight group transactions where assets are moved around within a group and there never is any cash out are going to be negatively impacted by that. And lastly, leverage transactions, which I understand is going to be the subject of a very particular presentation later on. Just to go through these quickly in outline, a BEE transaction, typically now, where we're looking for broad-based participation. When you go for broad-based participation, you're really looking at targeting and involving people that have no money. So they can't come up with the 100 million that's required to take up a 25% equity stake. So the way these transactions are now structured is the operating business that is to be empowered is transferred into a new company. Now that new company, prior to the transfer, has a nominal share capital of, say, 100 grand. 75 shares held by the existing group at 75 grand and 25 shares held by the BE. The BE guys come in and they need to come up with 25 grand in total. What then happens is the existing business is transferred within the group to the new co on loan account or for cash which is funded from an external bank. So the BE guys are out at the side, they have full ownership from day one, they have no personal liability because the liability remains in the company, and the vendor group effectively guarantees this. And we can touch on that in a second. Now what's happening is if that sale is funded by external debt, so that there's cash paid across, no relief will apply. Ultimately what that means is the vendor group has to pay the tax up front, and the only way they're going to be willing to do that is by recovering that cost by way of an additional interest charge to the BEE empowered company. In the case where it's an internal loan note, similar concept applies because they know full well that when the loan note is repaid, they're going to pay tax, which is again going to adjust by way of an extra interest cost to the BEE partner. So this is very much a real problem for broad-based empowerment. We need to get that leveraged company to be able to allow the guys access at a cheap level. We then deal with another class of transactions, which is securitization. Very similar concept in one regard, in that assets are dropped down into a new company against debt. But what happens here is, a good example is where an existing operating company has got borrowing. They may well be able to borrow in the operating company at, say, prime less 1%, because the bank effectively ranks as a creditor amongst with all the other creditors in that company. To give the bank additional security, what happens is the assets are transferred down into a new company, and the bank lends direct into that company as the sole creditor, so it takes on less risk, and as a result of that, it's able to give you a better borrowing rate. So they may move from prime minus 1 to prime minus 2. Again, in this scenario, if the money goes into the new co first, and the assets are purchased for cash, all of a sudden there's no relief. There's a tax cost that upfront tax cost would actually wipe out the saving of the reduced interest rate. If they're sold down on loan account, well, the reality is the money coming in from the bank is going to be used to repay that loan account, and you're going to get hit with the tax at that point in any event. Just quickly, the concept here for the other transactions is the same, in that the media statement's quite explicit in saying we're targeting cash out. Where we move assets around within a group, however, now, where there's never any cash out, we're either going to be nailed with tax up front or transfer on loan account hit with double tax with no means of mitigating the cascading effect. I mean, that's a very broad summary. As I say, I'm aware that as regards leveraged transactions, Weber Wentzel's a far more detailed slide, so I'll leave that for them to address later in the morning. That's our, in short, our issues with Section 45. The one other aspect that I would like to briefly touch on, and I'm sure other parties will mention this also, and I'm equally sure that it's not an unfamiliar issue to the committee, is the whole issue of timing of this process. I mean, we're looking this time round, I must say, we've actually moved back slightly from last year. We're in a worse position in terms of the ability of stakeholders to have a meaningful period to comment. The documents, the media statements, whilst the media statements were released on the 21st, which was a Thursday, the actual bill itself showing us the detailed wording, which is obviously the devil is in the detail for us to comment on, was only available on the 22nd on both STAR's website and Treasury's website. We then only had 5 working days to be able to comment to the committee. Now, we had to comment to the committee by noon the following Friday. There is a slightly longer extension period in that the comments to STAR and Treasury had a deadline of today. But I'm not convinced that actually helps the committee, in that a late submission to SARS and Treasury the committee may not then also be aware of. The other aspect, I am aware of at least one other party that sought an audience before the committee today, because of the tight deadline, were unable to obtain a slot. So I've just highlighted, whilst you will hear from many parties today, you're by no means hearing from all the parties, the interested parties that would have liked to present it to you. And I think the final aspect on that is this bill typically is a relatively straightforward bill. The introduction to the bill itself says it's routine tax rate changes, etc. But I think you'll see from what we've said already, the extent of the impact of the change in one section in this instance has a vast magnitude affecting a number of classes of transactions significantly. And the short period to comment in this regard is less than desirable, shall we say. The one point Keith did actually make yesterday was, he's quite right, if we look at last year's bill at the same time, there was a specific anti-avoidance measure inserted there as well, in the same way as this is. The key difference, I would say, is that that was a very targeted one. It was very targeted, it impacted a number of transactions, it was a very specific loophole. Here, this year, unfortunately, we have something, again, it's targeted at specific anti-avoidance, which we agree must be closed, but the breadth of its scope is frightening. And I think, for that reason, the consultation period is too short. That being said, I'd like to thank you again for the time just now, and Chair, I think you have more than enough presenters still to come. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair, honourable members. If I can also start by thanking you for the opportunity for Osman Malaji and myself, David Lerma, to present to you on our representations and essentially give you an oral submission to support the written submissions that have already been given. What we're going to go through today is essentially two areas of main concern and five areas of looking at specific provisions. Go to the first one. If I can start where James just finished off, and that was the question of why are we here today? Because we have been presenting, I think, in this forum for probably double digits now in terms of years, and this is the first time that people have come to this session. These sort of consultations and discussions are normally taking place at the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill later in the year when you have substantive and potentially controversial issues that are being laid before the Portfolio Committee on Finance to consider whether or not the right balance is there. This year, as you heard, we have the example of the Section 45 relief, which is simply an avoidance provision gone too far. So much that the medicine is far worse than the illness. And you will see that apart from ourselves, and why we're privileged to be speaking today, is because there are a number of people that could not get a slot. Why? Because we're not expecting, and I don't think the committee would be expecting, to have this sort of discussion at this time of year. It's usually to deal with our rates, tax rebates, non-contentious items, or adjustments which have flown forward from previous years, and there really isn't an issue. So we had five working days, and we heard yesterday that the Minerals and Petroleum Royalties, Resources Royalties Bill was first drafted in 2003 and went through 3 years of public consultation. We have a section that runs through the breadth of industry, and we have a consultation period of 5 days. I've been looking at what we've been saying. We've been coming through, and we've been saying constantly that we can be proud of what National Treasury and SARS and the committee has been doing these last few years. We do have one of the best tax systems in the world, and the tax administration just gets better and better every year. There isn't a problem with tax collection these days. We know that from the budget. This is the first time, however, when people are stopping, they're standing, they're waving red flags and say, hold up and take a breath. Because if, for example, we had just frustrated group transactions, which the provision does as it currently stands, we are making a very negative and retrospective move. And that's why you've got the wealth of outcry at the moment. The good news is that because of this process, it has been brought out very quickly. And also that there is a meeting this afternoon between interested parties, National Treasury and SARS, the sole purpose of getting it right. But I just want to raise that one issue. Should we all be under this pressure? We raise it every year, and every year it gets worse. From private discussions with National Treasury, we know that there is a wealth of legislative change that needs to be dealt with. And it's the Portfolio Committee's, I think, a chance to look at this and consider whether it is appropriate. If I look at my last point, and this is one that was made more forcefully, I think, last year as well, and that is that today is the last chance. You will hear public representations orally today. You will have their written representations. SARS will look at them, and I'm not sure of the timetable, but by 17th of March, that's the drop-dead date. I think that's when it goes to the printers. And between now and then, there is no further chance for anyone to vet or review what happens. You will simply get a report, a very good report, that comes back from National Treasury and SARS, lists all the reps and says what they have done with them. but there is no opportunity for anyone to suggest whether any of the comments have been misconceived, misunderstood, or equally simply the wrong policy. And that is really, for me, the only flaw that I identify in this process. I'm now going to pass to Osmond, and if I can just make a quick brief comment and welcome his class of postgraduates. We obviously felt we needed some support, so we've got them here from UWC. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's good to hear you. I was wondering what's happening. Thank you, and we wish you well in your entire career. Welcome.
Thank you, Jay. The second of our general submissions is the point about our approach to anti-avoidance. And I suppose, I mean, there are going to be quite a few specific submissions that we're going to get to in a minute. But one of the themes that really transcends many of them is the question of why are we not spending more time, why are we not focusing on using the general anti-avoidance rules that we already have. Now, South Africa already has relatively sophisticated general anti-avoidance rules, the type of general anti-avoidance rules that make many other tax jurisdictions envious of South Africa. And this is the result of a long, long consultation period. It came into effect in 2006, but the consultation started long before that. I mean, I think we have some of the drafters of the original discussion documents with us here today who can perhaps vouch for the fact that this is really, really good legislation. The question that arises, if we have such good general anti-avoidance rule, why do we need to constantly resort to specific anti-avoidance measures? And the big drawback, of course, of specific anti-avoidance measures, and I do think they are warranted in some cases, but the point, of course, is that you really, really do need to get them right. If they are too narrow, if they are too specific, it's not that difficult to get around them, so you don't want to make them too narrow. But one of the themes that really goes across many of the points we're going to make today is sometimes, because we're too scared to make them too narrow, we make them way too broad. Sometimes you need to attack something with a scalpel-like precision, and you end up using a sledgehammer, which is the point that Bravura made as well. If you want to kill the wolf, there's no point in really using a weapon of mass destruction to kill all the sheep as well. So if we are going to resort to using specific anti-avoidance measures, we need to be very careful, and which goes to David's first point, which is consult. Let's do this together. My point here today is not to say that these abusive avoidance schemes should not be attacked. Yes, we should. But let's go through it sensibly, and let's invite enough and sufficient consultations for everyone.
I think the next point is going on to specific concerns, and this one is essentially the provision which seeks to tax non-residents when they enter the country. Essentially, in the main, it is referring to controlled foreign companies that's within a South African group, and when they transfer into South Africa and become fully taxable in the South African net, the provision at the moment seeks to charge them a tax on any inherent gain in their assets. So we have a provision that actually taxes companies that are coming to South Africa. And apart from that sounding, you know, completely wrong, it is totally singular in that I don't believe, I'm aware, someone will need to find me one, of any other country that seeks to tax a vehicle or a person that is now becoming subject to South African tax in total. What it's doing is it's saying, I'm a company, I have growth in my assets, I'm not subject to South African tax, and I have got significant gains, I choose to move my business, I choose to come into South Africa and become a tax resident and start using its infrastructure, and our tax law nor used to say, or says currently, that we have a rebasing, that we're not going to tax the gains that accrued before we became subject to tax in South Africa. What this law does says, not only are we going to tax those gains, we are going to tax them now. on entry into the country. And we're simply saying that this really doesn't make sense. We should be incentivizing groups coming to South Africa and not giving them a tax charge on arrival. Now, clearly, there is a specific avoidance or tax leakage that Treasury and SARS wish to prevent, and it relates more to exits than entrance. And I think all we're saying is that with the consultation, we need to focus on the exit and not the entrance. There's also a comment, a very disturbing comment, that says that the participation exemption may be considered as no longer necessary, and suggests that the objective of that exemption was to ease the repatriation of funds to South Africa. And I need to tell you that that is not the whole background. Our background is fully given in our representation, but that is correct that it was amended and expanded to enable dividends to come back to South Africa, and dividends in, I think it was 2003, were made, you know, came back and were exempt. But originally, in 2001, this provision was simply a provision in the controlled foreign company legislation. So it was looking at South African multinationals that have groups overseas. And it was done at the time because of international competitiveness. Research was done. I remember making representations at the time and showing that the UK did not have capital gains tax. Still doesn't. They consider it from now to time. They don't have capital gains tax on their CFCs. And the reason they give is because it's just too complicated, too much of an administrative problem. We identified that as a possible avenue, but that wasn't the way at that time that it was thought best for the country to go. And instead, it went for a participation exemption that was strongly used in Europe. And, you know, sometimes you have a vision, but it is not until you have hindsight that you know how well you've actually done. And that decision has put South Africa and its tax system up there best in class. I've been talking to colleagues around the world, and the conversation I had in the last few days with my colleague in Canada said, you know what, we've just created a panel to look at the system of international tax in Canada, and what we are considering is those countries with the participation exemption. Our system's been around for 30 years, it was the best, it's now, you know, we need to refine it. So, just raising the flag, you'll hear more on this if indeed provisions come forward that try to take away what I believe is actually a competitive edge that we have in our tax system. Obviously, one must have specific rules if it's being abused, but not a general destruction.
The next of our specific concerns deals with the Section 45 intergroup transaction, which, as you would have seen, was the sole focus of Bravura's entire presentation. I mean, it's just one of the points on our list. There is a bit of repetition in what I'm about to say, but I hope that I hope that demonstrates what a really big deal this is, and how concerned we are about the proposal. Just a quick recap or background of Section 45. The objective really is to facilitate the transfer of assets within a group. It doesn't give up the tax, it just defers the tax and says that while the asset remains in that group and moves from one company to another company in the same group, that's okay, we won't take the tax at that point. It's not a permanent giving up of the tax, but we will take it when it leaves the group. That's the intention, that's the objective. The two proposals that worry us is the first, well, first of all, the point that it's now only available really where there's a debt instrument. Bravura made the point early on that it's not, technically, it's not the only time it's available. It's also available if there's a donation. But really, if we take into account things like minorities, creditors, corporate governance, and things like that, it's less likely to take place in the context of a donation. So, cash transactions, asset swaps, which are really typical of everyday transactions within groups, those are simply not, they simply do not qualify anymore. So we've been forced into the issuing of a debt instrument in Section 45. And then the bigger point is that Section 45 then manufactures a capital gain on that debt instrument, a capital gain that did not exist before, that would not have existed even if we didn't have Section 45. And if I can just use a quick illustration, the first column that I've got there states the original position. If we didn't have Section 45 and we have an asset being sold from A to B, and then B eventually sells the asset out of the group, if A makes the gain of 50, there would be tax on it, and if B then sells it for a higher price of 180 out of the group, they would be taxed on the gain of 30 that they would make. So in total, revenue should collect 80, which is correct. The second column, which deals with the Section 45 position, you can see that in the end, the full 80 is collected. The only thing that happens is that Company A pays nothing, because after that transfer, the asset is still in the group. It hasn't left the group yet. Only once Company B sells it is the full 80 collected. So Company B pays more tax. There's no loss to the FISC. The full 80 is collected. The new subsection 3A, which creates this gain on the debt instrument, retains the existing position and simply adds an additional level of taxation. That 50 Rand that was originally taxed or would originally have been taxed in Company A is duplicated in the debt instrument. So the point of, I suppose the big point that we're trying to make is this makes Section 45, it really turns it from a relief provision that we all wanted to use to a penal provision that we should be warning people to stay away from.
Just to finish off with a few sundry issues, I'm going to do this one, and Osman will finish off with the last two. But this one actually is not corporate. It's I believe it's very important. I remember there was one provision once that everyone agreed on, and then the printers actually didn't put it into the bill. And this, I apologise, happened with us. So you have an addendum. It's regarding the expatriate exemption on accommodation, and essentially all we're saying is that we applaud the giving of further relief, but we believe it should be consistent with the policy of Home Affairs, it should be consistent with our own tax residence rules, and we should really therefore be giving this exemption for 4 or 5 years, not the 2. Home Affairs have done research and they believe that it takes at least 4 years for appropriate skills transfer. And we look at this and look at our country, look at our back pattern, and we say this is crucial, it's critical, it's needed, and this is an example where the tax system actually supports very directly an economic need. And therefore... No, not at all. This is one that you have to recall that this provision has been changed before it even started, because it was only due to start at the beginning of this month, and it was changed in recognition of that before the start of this month. I think all I'm saying is please look at the facts and you will see that there is a consistent policy that we could have here. The other issues on there are technical issues, and I'm sure that we'll deal with those directly with National Treasury and so on.
Okay, just to finish up, then we just two more issues that we want to raise in this oral presentation. The first one goes to the new Section 23K, which proposes to limit the expenditure for share purchases, where shares are purchased from connected persons, or have previously been held by connected persons. Now, the way it's currently written is really a demonstration of that wide ambit. In the media release that accompanied this amendment, we were given a very specific avoidance scheme. And again, I want to repeat the point. We see the scheme, we understand it, and we agree with Treasury and SARS that we need to do what we can to stop it. But I think this really illustrates the point, and we need to be clear and specific on what we are targeting and be very careful about the collateral damage we're catching on the side. Now, from a media statement that says we're targeting situations where we have a non-resident parent, we're sitting here with a provision that applies to everyone, South African, fully South African groups, with no non-resident participation at all. So it just applies across the board to everyone, to you and I, if we were connected, with having shares to each other. In the way that it's written, it is salvageable, but it, and The devil, naturally, is in the detail. But again, our request is, have a look at this, let's consult, let's narrow it down and catch who we're supposed to be catching. And I just want final point, which is more of an administrative matter. And this is the effective date. Everyone was applauding National Treasury for the 1 million threshold for VAT registration. I suppose we should point out that we think it's long overdue, but thank you for that. The increase of the threshold from 300,000 for registration to 1 million was welcomed, but the effective date is set at the 1st of January 2009, which does mean that if you're a new business starting up today and you have sales of 500,000 or under 1 million, it does mean you have to go through the process of registering for VAT today and stay registered for the rest of the year, simply to be registered at the end of the year when the new threshold comes into operation. So our request is make the new threshold effective immediately, and then if the new threshold will really achieve its objective of keeping the small businesses out of the compliance net, which is really the objective of the threshold change. Any final comments? Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you. We're not doing bad for time. We'll take the next cycle. I just hope that members have been noting questions, and also when we're taking questions and comments from members, we'll allow a very brief opportunity, because one of the things we have since started trying to do is to ensure that National Treasury and SARS are one on the understanding of the issues that are being raised, so that when we get responses, that has also been clarified instead of leaving it beyond. Okay. Saika, Mr. Smith, go ahead. The floor is yours. What's going on?
Thank you, Chief.
We do not have a PowerPoint presentation for SAICA, but there is a presentation that has been circulated to members. Are you going to be speaking to that one? It is TLAB4. Can we make sure that... Yeah, no, it's not in the package. We received it last night. Can you just circulate that? TLA before? Okay. Okay. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Cycle would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to make this oral presentation. Regarding the time limit, I know it has been emphasized now on two presentations just before me, but being such a crucial issue, we would like to emphasize it again, just giving an idea of the submission by SAICA. This is a submission from the comments we receive from all our members. Now, being a big organization with thousands of members, what we do, we circulate for comments, we get comments from our members, then we try to identify a common thing, and we put it together into one document. To get sufficient time, comments, we need sufficient time, and I mean 5 working days probably won't do it, and I think there's a lot of our members who would have liked to comment or commented late, we just had to ignore their comments and couldn't incorporate it into our document here. Another big issue for us is, as this is such a lot of technical amendments here, we have a concern that there is going to be practical problems that's going to slip through the net, and those problems might have to be corrected at a later tax amendment date again, which is not ideal, and it has happened in the past, and for that to be avoided, a longer consultation period and time for comments is needed. Further, just a small point, again there has been 2 items on the amendment which have been backdated, and we would like to express our concerns as far as certainty for taxpayers and tax consultants in the market. Examples of those items is distribution, the definition of distribution, in section 47(1) of the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, which came into effect, they say, from 1 October 2001, so that definition has been backdated, as well as the definition of refining in section 53(1) of the Draft Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, which came into effect now from 2 November 2006. We really feel for certainty in the market, for taxpayers and tax advisors, items shouldn't be backdated and should only be applied going forward. If you can refer you to our submission page 2 on the paragraph 2.1, subclause 2.1K in the middle of the page, where the basically paragraph E to the definition of gross income has been replaced, which dealt with the specific inclusion of lump sums received from retirement funds. Now, in principle, we agree with the replacement of the definition. It's just in the new definition there, basically the old exemption for which referred to section 91G, we dealt with the exclusion of the lump sum amount, exemption of it, for services rendered not in South Africa, not included in the new definition again. We don't know if that was an intended consequence. The consequence is if you receive a lump sum from a Provident Pension Retirement Annuity Fund, and some of the year service related to services provided outside South Africa, it now appears that the whole lump sum will be taxable in South Africa. Compare that to the pension that you receive from such a monthly or annual pension. Section 101 GC still exempt part of that pension if it relates to the foreign service rendered, as well as a section like section 10102, which exempt remuneration received if the requirements of that section have been met and the services were rendered outside South Africa. So we felt for equitable treatment, that exemption should still be included in paragraph E if services were rendered outside South Africa, and the reference to section 91G should probably be reinstated in that definition. If I could further commit you to page 4 at the top, paragraph 2.2 of our submission. Just a small item, we would like to first extend the extension of the exclusion of passive income in section 91D to the reduction of debt is welcome, and we appreciate that. The only concern that we have is that the new paragraph which replaced section 9G9FA does not provide for the election of the taxpayer which it previously had for the exclusion not to apply. We still feel that that election is still needed there. On the bottom of page 5, paragraph 2.8 of our submission, firstly, we would like to thank National Treasury for looking at the de-grouping the provisions and giving some relief to the taxpayer. Those items have been identified during the last presentations in November, and we would like to thank them for re-looking at the de-grouping provisions. Now, looking at the group definition in section 41, during the submissions in November, concerns were raised regarding the exclusion of foreign companies from the new so-called groups. Basically, the revised group definition excluded companies which were not completely within the South African tax net, and they wouldn't form part of a group for paragraph section 41 and would not apply for the intergroup relief. Now, the relief has been given here, whereas companies registered as an external company in terms of the Companies Act of 1973 are now included if they are fully within the South African tax net, therefore effectively managed within South Africa. Unfortunately still, CFCs, the so-called controlled foreign companies, being within the South African tax net, still doesn't form part of the group as they are not falling within that definition. We feel that as there are taxable entities in South Africa and fall within the South African tax net, that they should also form part of the group as per the paragraph section 41 definition there. Continuing on the definition of a group in paragraph section 41, If we look at the bottom of page 7 of our submission, paragraph 2.9 there, we still would like to emphasize the exclusion of a group or a company who receives exempt income. I mean, looking at the current wording still there, it seems that if you receive any exempt income, that you will not form part of a group. Now, I mean, that has been raised in November, and from the response document from National Treasury, it appears that it was going to be corrected, but at the moment it's still the way it reads as that if you receive any exempt income, for example, dividends, you probably will be excluded from a group, and that basically will mean that all companies will be excluded from a group, as most companies receive some sort of exempt income. Page 8 of our submission, paragraph 2.10 there at the bottom, refers to the so-called section 45 amendments into group relief. Now, firstly I would like to say we support the submissions being done by Bavaria and PwC. I'm not going to go into that much detail as our submission is the substance of it is basically the same. I would like to emphasize that both parts of it, first being the cash transactions, if the purchase price being settled by cash, now being excluded from the so-called Section 45 relief, we again raise our concerns as a lot of legitimate business transactions will now fall outside the scope of Section 45. Again, with examples we would like to raise, this is so-called BE transactions which are internally funded, BE transactions externally funded, securitizations, and leverage transactions being some of the main categories which we felt where the relief is needed, and the extra tax cost at that time of the transaction will make some of these transactions in practice not workable, and they will not continue. As for the other part of the amendment, the one which now deals with the loan instrument, where the base cost of the loan is set at the lower of the market value, or basically the base cost or the Section 11A cost transferred. Again, we would like to raise the concerns regarding the double taxation or potential double taxation when the loan liability is later on being settled, being the tax liability for the party that now got when the loan is settled, as well as for the actual company which sells the asset there. As I'd like to emphasize, I'm not going to go into further examples. I think the issue has been dealt with there quite comprehensively by the previous two presenters. I would like to point your attention to the committee to page 10 of our submission, paragraph 2.11. The amendment, suggested amendment to section 64B5F, excludes from the exemption of SPC secondary tax on companies within a group a dividend declared by a controlling company to a controlled company. We are unsure as to the profits are still remaining in the group. We are unsure why this exemption has been excluded for those type of dividends. The explanatory memorandum does not provide any further information on that. On page 13 of our submission, paragraph 4.2, we're now into the bit which deals with the second draft taxation laws amendment bill, being the amendments to the employee tax, the fourth schedule, paragraph 18 and 20. The first point of concern is the introduction of a new penalty for employers who submit their so-called annual return for employee tax, being the IMP 501 reconciliation late. It's going to be a 10% of the total employee tax deducted and withheld during the year. Now, I mean, you can do the sums. I mean, big organizations having a large number of employees, it could be a huge penalty. And we feel that the amount of this penalty can be enormous, and it's, in our opinion, out of proportion to the actual offense that is being in question here. More concern for us at this stage is the additional amendment there, which now will disallow an employee a PAYE deduction until the employer has submitted the return to the IMP 501. So basically, employee who's got the IRB file at the end of the year, when his employer, his or her employer, has not submitted their return, will not be allowed the PAYE credit for the tax being paid. Now the concern is mean that employee, that is called the deduction of employee tax from the employee's salary is compulsory. The employee doesn't have a choice for it. The employer being the agent, the employee does not have control over the employer submitting the return. So even though the employee has paid the tax by way of deduction of his salary, by administrative requirements such a return not being lodged by his employer, the employee will now not get the credit for the PAYE deducted until the employer submits the return. Now, the logic behind this, we can see that obviously they want to make it, put more pressure on employers to submit the annual returns, but by punishing the innocent bystander, the employee, for the employer not submitting the return, goes against the grain of the actual tax system, and we also have concerns from members about the constitutionality of that or not. So therefore, it's a serious concern there. If we move on to paragraph 4.3 of our submission, still on page 13, dealing with the requirements of the value-added tax, VAT, and specifically deletion of section 44.3 of the Value-Added Tax Act. Now, no explanation has been provided in the explanatory memorandum why this section has been deleted. Just a few practical implications. This section deals with the option of the vendor not using his own bank account, but using the bank account of a representative taxpayer, and that taxpayer might not have a bank account in South Africa. Now, in certain cases, the problem with this is in certain cases, for example, foreign companies have branches, which by requirement of the definition of an enterprise in Section 1 of the Act, must register as a bank vendor in South Africa. Those branches might not have any physical presence in South Africa, therefore they don't have employees, they don't have any payments which are being made here. For them now, they can't use a representative bank account to open a bank account in South Africa due to the Financial Intelligence Center Act, the so-called FICA Act, might even be impossible. I mean, the requirements saying that you must have a utility bill to prove your residential address from and all the other requirements there which they will probably not meet. And being seen from the point of view of the bank being reluctant just to open a bank account which is never going to be used, might be impossible then for them to fulfill the requirement to register as a bank vendor. Another point on that same issue still on page 15, even in certain group companies of South Africa, all the companies within the group used one bank account. That is meant to reduce the cost of banking, reducing the cost of business in general, and to control the cash flow and to optimal use of the cash within the business. Now, even in such circumstances, it now appears with the deletion of section 44.3G that all those companies within the group will now be forced to open their own separate bank account. Now, being South African companies, it probably won't be a problem, but it will definitely increase the cost of doing business. The last point on page 16 of our submission, which I would like to emphasize, is again the same as so the previous presenters have done, that the VAT, the increase of the VAT threshold from 300,000 to 1 million rand is welcome. But as it has been announced in the budget speech, I mean, public perception is that it will become effect immediately. If it only comes into effect in a later date, some vendors might have to register now and then deregister in 8 or 9 months' time, which, I mean, again, contributes towards the cost of business and makes no commercial sense. So we would recommend the immediate introduction of the an increase in the threshold. To the Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity to make this presentation. I only highlighted certain points on our whole submission there. The committee has got the whole submission, and I hope it will contribute towards the process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. I'm going to ask that we try and line our panel here, and if it's not going to be too much inconvenience for members and some of the people sitting there, if we could shift down, I can just allow for for them to, for just the three of them to be here. Yeah, just a slight shift for members. My apologies. Yeah. Mr. Singh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Oh, Dr. George, you're... Is that fine? Okay. I don't know, Bradley will find himself. Okay, thanks very much. A number of similarities in your presentations, but members will be directing questions either to all of you at the same time or, but if we could try and keep our questions, members, short and responses also as short. You did well in your presentations, the timing was good. And after that, I'll also just try and find an opportunity for National Treasury in South to clarify some of the issues that you have raised and also to check whether you have the same understanding on matters where you raised some critical points. That's not the official response, but for them to be able to get a proper understanding whether you are one on some of these issues. Also to say that in as much as, you know, the issue of the timing is problematic, it's also problematic for the committee as well. More particularly when you get the submission on the day. So, I mean, if you could look at that, it also impacts because we also want to be able to go through this. I mean, just reading it and be able to digest helps our understanding of issues. Okay, we'll allow for questions of clarity, comments, members, Mr. Mloto, Dr. George, Mr. Mare, Mr. Mguni. Is your hand up, Mr. Mguni? No, okay. I wasn't too sure. Who have we got? We've got Mr. Mloto, Dr. George, Mr. Mare, Mr. Mguni, Mr. Singh. Okay, let's take those.
Thank you, Chair. This is a very, very difficult subject indeed. I'll try my best. I share your concerns about the possibility of double taxation. But can you clarify to me how would that arise, especially in the light of one, I understand this other part, where you say on the sale of the assets, when the assets leave the group, there will be a tax. But then you go further to argue that when the loan is being repaid, there will be a tax. Can you explain to me how that arises, repayment of tax on a loan?
The second question is, the view has been expressed that interest on shared deductions should not be allowed. The argument is that the interest should then be focused on active business, not on shareholding. What's your view on that? The last question, Chair, I think I might have misplaced it. The last question is on the repatriation of dividend tax free. And you expressed a concern about a tax on a company coming to South Africa. Basically, you're arguing that should be exempt or it should be rebased to a level where the taxpayer wouldn't be eligible to pay tax. Now, a view also has been expressed that consideration should be given to shares that have been held by the headquarters company. I'm referring to a slide. I'm misunderstanding it. I'm referring to a slide from National Treasury and SARS, where they are talking about indirect domicile, and they are talking that level one. That's where the real issue should be. Where they say gain on HQ control shares should be looked into. What's your view? If you don't understand it, I can come back to it. Am I clear on that was the last question? Not quite.
Perhaps let's clarify it when they respond to it if they might have misunderstood. Okay, let's then take it to the judge.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question for Bravura. Your submission suggests that proposals under Section 45 will have a substantial negative influence on corporate finance generally. Won't the market just adapt to the new dispensation, or are there structural reasons why it couldn't or wouldn't? And then to PwC, you mentioned that existing general anti-avoidance rules should be used. Have you made proposals on how this can be done to resolve the avoidance that we now seem to have that necessitates these amendments? Thank you.
Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to address this to all the three parties and get their comments on the following. In the budget speech, which we all applauded, it was indicated that a relaxation of requirements and the cost of doing business and the fact that we need foreign direct investment. Would the cost of doing business be negatively affected by this, and in what way? And will we lose a possible competitive edge? Your comments is on that, please.
Mr. Mwani.
Thanks, Chair. My question, Chair, is on the period for comment on the submissions. I think it's been 4 years each time all parties do complain about the submissions. So I don't know what is the reasonable time that you need to fail comment on the submissions, on the fee. And my second question is on the Section 45 to all the presenters. The main area is to cap on tax avoidance and also to be for the tax to be fairly administrative, to be easy. Now, what do you think could be the proper way to avoid people from dodging tax when they are financing PEEs? Because I think there might be a way in which they can avoid tax and finance PEEs. Now, what do you think is the proper way to avoid that? Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to align myself with the question by colleague Mguni, because that was one of the questions. And also colleague Georgia about alternative proposals. You mentioned Section 47. And I think Professor Malagi made quite a strong statement that Section 45, the amended Section 45 or the proposed amendment, will turn it from a relief position to a penal position. And can you just unpack that for us, and also the impact on future BBB transactions with the amendments?
Okay. Let's get responses to those questions. In any order.
Okay. I think what we'll try and do here is I'll go down the list from all the members addressing certain of the points, and then David will pick up on the other aspects that we didn't comment on, and then Psyche can come in, and then if there's anything we've missed, we can do another quick round. I think the first question from Mr. Malota was, how does the double tax actually arise? I think to cast that in the right light, you have to first think of the group as a single entity, which is the point behind group relief and group taxation. We're not group taxation yet, but we do have restricted measures for group relief. Where you then have the example I used on the board with a parent company with two subsidiaries, you do a sale of an asset from one subsidiary to another. Yeah. The first tax triggers when the subsidiary sells out of the group. That's level one of tax. The second level of tax arises because what the proposal does is it says, if I sell something on loan account, I sell something on loan account for a market value of 100, but my tax basis, or my tax base cost in the loan, is 20, being the price that I originally paid for it. So then when the loan is repaid, I receive proceeds of 100, but I've only got a tax cost of 20, so then I get taxed on the 80 again. So one company is taxed on 80, being the proceeds from the external sale, and then within the group, you're taxed on the 80 a second time round.
I think the point you've actually identified is the real problem, is that the loan is given a basis that is less than the face value. So I have a loan of 100 that arose from the sale of the asset, but the tax is treated at 20. So as soon as it's repaid, because you have to pay the whole indebtedness of 100, you have 80 of gain, which is a new additional gain that was never before there but for this legislation.
I'm turning to your second question. I'll touch on this very briefly because I'm aware that it's going to be dealt with in depth this afternoon by Weber Wenzel on the question of interest on share deductions. Currently, I'll just comment that currently under existing legislation you do not get an interest deduction on loans taken out to fund the purchase of shares. The base principle under our domestic legislation currently is in order to get a deduction you have to generate income. Income being proceeds less exempt income. And typically when you buy the shares, you are buying them and you will receive dividends which are exempt. So because the purchase of the share generates exempt income, you don't get the interest deduction. As I say, Weber's will go through a specific example this morning in the context of leverage transactions and will, I trust, deal with it in more detail then.
I think all that I would want to add is that that is one area where clearly national tax policy will be looking at that, because it's one of the areas where many of our competitors and treaty countries do give a deduction for interest. And there are many examples where our tenders are uncompetitive because we don't get that interest deduction. So it's not something, I think, to dwell on in this legislation, but it is certainly something that is in the pipeline to look at from an international competitiveness. It needs further work.
I don't know, do you want to deal with Nick Lord's third question now before we move on? The repatriation.
Okay, the repatriation. As the law currently stands, dividends that are repatriated to South Africa can be repatriated without further South African tax costs, provided you have a 20% equity stake in the shares in the company that's paying the dividends. And that's just been tightened slightly so that you also have to have 20% of the voting rights. That's the amendment this time round. And that is very close to a lot of the European participation exemptions. It doesn't go quite as far, because in Europe you can actually also sell shares to another domestic, you know, so a Dutch person can sell, a Dutch company can sell the shares to another Dutch company and it would be exempt. So we don't go quite as far as that, but certainly what we have done has put us on a level that that other countries are looking at and saying, you know, is this something we should do? The UK issued a paper in July last year. They've taxed dividends forever and a day and given a foreign tax credit against the dividend, and they are considering, you know, whether they should have exemption. Canada provides for exemption. Again, the key difference is between active business and passive investment, and it appears as long as we stick to those fundamental principles of supporting active business and taxing simple investment income to the extent we can, that seems to be very much the global trend and good practice.
I just want to add, I seem to recall it being part of the same question, and just the whole concept of rebasing for CGT and what that meant. And I just wanted to use a very basic example. It becomes very, a lot messier when you start dealing with CSDs that are already part of the SA tax net effectively. But at the very root level, if we're talking about non-residents coming into South Africa, the point about rebasing is to say, just to use an example, if you've got someone who is not a resident and wants to migrate here, if they already have assets of 100, but they originally bought those assets for 80, the point is for us to say, look, you can come here and we will pretend that your base cost, your starting point is 100. We're not going to tax you on that gain that you were earning before you came to South Africa. So that point about not charging an entry fee for coming into South Africa really goes to that point. That's, and that's what we referred to when we were talking about rebasing. I hope that clarifies that.
Sorry, there was a question that hadn't been answered, and you asked about this level one, which was a thing requiring clarification. And I think the concern there, I'm sure Professor Engel will correct me if I have misunderstood this, and that is the concern that it's fine to allow assets and persons into South Africa to become part of our tax system. What we've got to be careful of is the extent that there may be a way in which persons can leave South Africa tax-free and essentially get out of our system without any further charge. And I think that's where I said before, we need to focus on the exit, not the entrance. And clearly there are issues that Treasury have identified that are of concern, and I'm sure those are things we'll be discussing. But we've got to get specific anti-avoidance that prevents just that and doesn't give us collateral damage. But there's clearly something of concern there that they wish to deal with.
I think the next set of questions came from Dr. George. I'll address the one that was specifically targeted towards Brewera. The question was regarding is there a substantive negative influence and can the market adapt to it? I think what we try to do in the short time is identify a number of classes of transaction that are negatively impacted, be the BEE or securitization. The one that I'll tag on just now is where a domestic group moves its assets around within the group to reorganise on divisional lines because it's a more economically efficient way to do. Now, ultimately, you're quite right in that the market would always adapt to something like this, but the question is, does it adapt in a manner that gives better growth in the economy? And the concern is, I'll quickly go through each of those examples. As I said, in the BEE, if we trigger a cost under Section 45, ultimately that cost has to be borne somewhere. And typically it's going to have to be borne by the BEE partners by way of an increased interest rate to the either the lender or the existing group before the BEE partner starts to share in the growth in the operating business that it's become a member of. From a securitisation point of view, by putting this cost, upfront cost, into those transactions, you effectively negate the benefit of giving companies a chance to reduce their cost of funding. Now, if they were still to do that, ultimately somebody has to pay, and companies will typically pass the cost on to their customer. And whether passing that cost right down the chain is going to give the growth in the economy without the leakages is debatable. And then the third one is the case of where I simply transfer something around within my group. I'm not cashing out a piece of operating equipment, for example. I've moved it around so that I operate now in divisional lines. The intention of doing that is very much that my business is now more efficient. I can operate and keep track of things in a better way. Now, if there's an upfront cost, ultimately, yes, the market will adapt, but it's a cost that will then have to be factored into the business's operating model and passed on to the end consumer, whatever that end consumer actually is. So I think the nature of markets are that they will adapt, but it's a question of should they be forced to.
I think I just want to add that you asked whether it would increase the cost of doing business and would we have a less competitive edge with one of the comments, and the answer is yes. I mean, it's you're trying, you know, the economic theory or the purist will tell you about the group. You've heard me all the time. A group is an economic unit, needs to be taxed as a group. We have provisions here that are destroying the group. After years of putting a lot of work into getting good corporate reorg release in. And the one section and thing that we haven't had yet, and we understand is because people haven't shouted loud enough, is we don't have group taxation. That is, and today you've identified interest on shares and group taxation. Those are the things that are the next focus point. But this provision actually goes in the opposite direction, and hopefully after today there'll be a sort of compromise that solves that.
I think the next question went to the point about general anti-avoidance and the point about identifying specific abusive avoidance schemes And I think the specific question was, have we proposed a solution? Have we proposed a remedy? Because the point that I was making early on was that we have the general anti-avoidance rule. Why do we not apply? So I think my first response is, yes, has got to be to repeat that, was to say, why do we not use the general anti-avoidance rule? And if I can perhaps just take a minute to explain what we mean here. The difference between the specific and the general rule is that with specific anti-avoidance rules, we attempt to very narrowly and specifically describe the abusive scheme. So you would say, if a transaction looks like this and it's got these following five characteristics, then it will be attacked. Whereas the general anti-avoidance rule really, there's several discussions around it, but really the overriding point is that it places the issue before a group of humans with the ability to judge them on a case-by-case basis. So instead of writing into the law a whole lot of specific transactions, we have a general rule that says, if the intention looks bad here, we will look at it, and you can judge it on a case-by-case basis, taxpayer basis. So to respond to your question about a solution, I repeat the first point. Let's consider more deeply whether it could be caused by the general anti-avoidance rule. And in terms of our, I suppose, suggested solution, I think that's probably the focus of a discussion that's going to be had later today. But I would point out that opportunity to consult and actually come up together with a solution is a direct result of the fallout that we've had, or the response that we've had from this. If no one said to Treasury and SARS that we think you're casting the slightly too widely, how were they to know? And that is what I think is our job.
If we could just,
Thank you, Pluche. Just on the cost of doing business, just to summarize from the cycle side of comments we had, our members said a lot of transactions, especially the BE transactions, the additional cost, the tax cost, especially for the cash transactions now at the start, might just result in some of these transactions that cannot bear the additional cost, either through additional interest rates, etc., and it might not be workable and the transactions will fall through. That's sort of to summarize on that side. And then, if we could perhaps start on the next set of questions, that was asked the reasonable amount of time for commenting. I mean, it's very difficult. It obviously depends on the volume of the specific legislation changes. If we look at the set like we got on this, now there's a draft taxation laws amendment bill. I mean, from cycle side, to get reasonable comments from members, I would say minimum, we would have to be minimum 10 working days, ideally 15, but minimum 10 to get around. If we look at something like the revenue laws amendment towards the end of the year, which is a bigger pack, we might be even more, 3 weeks, I would say 15, probably minimum for us to get proper comments and consult with all our members on that set. But I mean, obviously sometimes it's an ideal world, what is workable or not in practice, there's other criteria as well. Thanks.
One comment was, there was a comment about the interest and whether there was too much sort of interest relief in relation to BE deals. And I think one of the comments that I wanted to make was that we do have a practice note that gives a safe harbour on interest that says that you can have debt to equity of 3-1. And there's aspects in that practice note that show and allows finance to be financed within South Africa, and specifically recognises that amount. So I think we need to be very careful that we don't take something and feel that it is immediately being a disguised transaction, and one has to look and see what is the commercial impact of what we're trying to achieve. And this, as we've heard, the transactions we're looking at just cancels virtually everything.
Okay. We answered all the questions. If we have, let's quickly take next one.
I think Professor Malagi has kind of covered, the strong statement that he made, that we're moving.
With regards to Section 75 not being
45,
a relief, being penalized instead of being relief.
Unless you want to say something else.
Okay. No, that's fine. Okay. Quickly, first, you're not supposed to be sitting there. You're supposed to be sitting very close to Keith. But, yeah. Nobody's setting out here. Yeah. Okay. You're trying to avoid the missile. let's a quick clarification of issues, and then we would want to break for tea and proceed with the hearing. Yeah.
And then Franz will protect me on the back flank. I don't want to get to all the issues, but I think the most important issue here is process. We understand that we have tight schedules. This year, it's going to be very tight. We have three bills. We have this bill, we have a royalty bill, and we have the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill. Not only to that, we have three bills, but we also have a tightened parliamentary schedule because there are other things on our docket, plus also we have an election year. That is the price of democracy. So, I'm very well aware, and if we could have more time, personally, from a personal point of view, I would have loved to have it. I really would. I pay a price at home as well as in this room right here, and so do all of my colleagues. And I am sympathetic to that. I just want to make a point here that we were acting in good faith. We had the budget, the minister made his speech on the 20th. On the 21st, we released. We tried to make sure we had a media statement on this point. It's the first, we've been using media statements now for the last several months. It's the first time. The purpose of the media statement is to highlight the biggies. All three issues here were the biggies. They were identified in the media statement. To make sure that these guys here knew in loud and public terms, look at this right away. We didn't put it on our website as of that day. However, my colleague and myself are not IT specialists, and the IT people decided to do something funny with the format this year on the website, and while it was indicated that it was there, somehow pushing the button created a little problem of one day, and then it was put again, and still it wasn't user-friendly enough, and then we moved it again. But it was always on the website, but it could have been in a friendlier location. That I apologize for. I'm not sure what I could have done, since I can barely use a computer myself, if you know me. Yeah, I can type, that's about it. But we did try to do that. And to some extent, whether it was shortcomings in the EM, we were trying to use the media statement for that. Now, in this transactions here, what we did last year, and some people here, those avoidance transactions last year were not as important, but for those people who care about those avoidance transactions last year, they were quite important. We're talking about big money here. This is not small chump change. We are talking about big money, and when you see big money like this, you can sit there quietly and walk away and say, well, it's just not convenient, let's wait, or you feel you have to take action. We felt in this case we had to take action. Difficulties that we've had in this 45 is that, as I said, I think it's got in the newspaper, I've been quoted in the newspaper, whether I have a job tomorrow or something else, but the point is that 45 has taken on a very different flavor than it was originally intended to. That is not to say that those different flavors are illegitimate, but it is a definitely different flavor. And so the rules have shifted slightly. The very rules that they are looking relief on have caused us the problem. But again, because we do want open consultation, the purpose was, and we were actually quite open about this, all the people who submitted comments, we called them, we said, can you meet today? Let's see if we can thrash it out. If we can't, I'll get yelled at home, but if we have to meet on a Saturday,
I think you're getting tempted to want to respond to these issues. All I want us to do in this exercise is to be clear that the issues that are being raised and the understanding between yourselves and the presenters are exactly as what they are, and that meeting you are talking about will deal with that, and your official response to the committee will fill the matter.
Well, thank you. So my apologies for my emotions there.
I know. The temptation is very, very high to actually want to respond. But if you could keep it, if there are issues where you say that their understanding is perhaps not correctly directed, this is what you meant, that would be okay on those issues. But if there is no such, let's leave it for that meeting, precisely the meeting that you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. If I could just build on one of the Honourable Member's questions, and that was the assertion that the GAR would apply. And I think it would be interesting for the presenters and the panel to indicate how on their analysis it would apply. Because, I mean, they're placing a lot of weight on it, and they're saying this is the way to proceed, and whilst I would concur that some of the transactions we are seeing are vulnerable to the application for GAR, it would be interesting to hear what their perspective is in that regard.
A general one on GAR, if any of you would want to be a spokesperson for the entire panel.
Okay, I think the point, perhaps just to clarify what our intention was there, was that we see time and time again each new amendment bill comes with more and more specific anti-avoidance provisions, and we don't see the application of the GAR. So in relation to the specific anti-avoidance or the specific abusive scheme that was outlined in the media release, for example, I don't think I'll be able to respond to Mr. Thomas's question and say, well, I think if the GAR was applied like this, you would catch it. But what I do see is a situation where we have 15 schemes coming through and 15 attempts to write specific avoidance provisions as opposed to any attempts to apply the GAR. So I might be mistaken here. There may be many applications of the GAR that are taking place, but having been involved or having participated in the process that actually brought the GAR to life, and having commented on it, it just confuses me that it seems to be lying there unused, and maybe in specific cases it can't be used. And then we do need the specific anti-avoidance rules. I'm not against them, the point that I did make this morning is that when specific anti-avoidance rules are warranted, let's consult widely and let's make them precise so that they can target what they're supposed to be targeting. I hope that deals with this question.
If I could just add, sorry, Matt, apologies. I think, what the GAR did, or the new GAR, was first of all, it has to be a sole or main purpose, has to be an avoidance of tax. If the sole or main purpose is a commercial one, then it's not possible to apply GAR. But then if the sole or main purpose is a commercial one, then, is there an avoidance provision that we're trying to attack? And that, unfortunately, is the grey area. As sort of planners, people will look and say, is this commercial or is this tax? Now, that's the 80-20 rule. When the amounts at stake are so great that the tax is so large, then I would guess that a court would look at that and they would have a presumption which the taxpayer would need to rebut that that wasn't one of the main purposes of the scheme. What Osman is saying, or Professor Malagi is saying, is that we haven't seen it tested. And it needs, we spent so long, over 2 years of looking at getting a new GAR in place, and it hasn't been used yet. And if it was used and it was effective, then you would avoid a lot of the time spent on these specific avoidance measures. The one issue there is that the new GAR allows you to look at each step and question each step as to whether it did pass the sole or main avoidance motive. And that is a much wider GAR than we had previously. And that was the purpose. So let's use it.
Okay, that's it. We break for tea, 10 minutes, and we come back and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You get some insight and say, well, trying to put it together and say, you know, what do we have here? And I think fundamentally we have a feeling on the part of Treasury and on the part of SARS that there are certain relief provisions introduced in the Act to facilitate, and we've heard a lot about Section 45 and transfer of assets within a group. Those are relief provisions that were introduced as a concession to taxpayers, and that these are now used in an abusive manner to avoid tax. And a lot of the submissions that you've heard on the part of practitioners is to say that we agree that the examples that you've highlighted in the media statement are abusive, but that the measures that you want to introduce to counteract the abuse will throw the baby out with the bathwater, and that it goes too far. And one needs to then look at alternative measures to see how can we do it, and what was said here is let's use the general anti-avoidance rule, the GAR, as it's called, to counteract some of these abusive transactions in the short term, and if we have here and we've looked at possible legislation to be introduced, let's do that let's use specific anti-avoidance rules, but let's be clear about how far these rules go and what their reach is. Because you don't want to cut, you don't want to kill all the sheep. I think where this stems from fundamentally is that our system of tax in South Africa is entity-based and not group-based. And what I mean by that is every company within a group of companies is taxed as a separate taxpayer. So that you could have a holding company with two subsidiaries. Subsidiary A could be making a profit and subsidiary B could be making a loss. But in terms of our rules, the loss that B makes cannot be offset against the gain that A makes, because they tax separately, although it's one economic unit, in a case where you've got a holding company that owns all the shares in the two subsidiaries. Now that is a concept that internationally clearly is not, internationally is not favored, and there is some recognition given that in order for us to be an attractive destination for foreigners to come into our country, and indeed for people to be conducting business in this country, there needs to be some recognition given to the fact that when you've got a group, that group is one economic entity, and we should try and facilitate the transfer of assets within that group and allow that group to do business in a flexible manner, which is consistent with the policy guidelines of trying to achieve economic growth. So because we don't have group taxation, and allied to that, because we have a system in South Africa, as was said here, where if you buy shares in a company, you can't get a tax deduction in respect to the interest that you incur to finance that acquisition. Because of those two factors, we've got a situation now where we've got these rules that are saying we will allow for the transfer of assets within a group in terms of Section 45 and the other ancillary rules, to allow taxpayers to run their business. Now what's happened clearly is that, and let's be frank about it, Treasury has identified
some abusive transactions. I'm sure they haven't identified all abusive transactions. People naturally tax is an impost, and it's a cost to a company, to any business, and taxpayers will look at reducing that cost like they look at reducing any cost in a company's books. So taxpayers will always look at possible ways of minimizing the tax burden. There's nothing wrong with that, nothing immoral about that, but clearly whatever you do needs to be within the confines of the tax system, and you should not, by what you're doing, should not place yourself outside the system or abuse the system in terms of the rules that have been drafted. The transactions identified in the media statement, some of those examples clearly are examples where the system is being abused, in that you're selling your assets to a third party, which does not form part of the group in the one example, and you use Section 45 in such a manner that you avoid having to pay tax on the cashing out of those assets. We've got our full sympathy. We agree with Treasury. Those are instances that one should try and curb that abuse. But what we're saying, as of the other submissions that have been made, what we're saying is that what is proposed in terms, specifically now looking at Section 45, because that's where a lot of the discussion went around, but it's not only Section 45, the other provisions as well. But what we say is, let's not rush in and prepare specific anti-avoidance legislation without proper consultation. This is a very technical area. These are for guys and women that are prepared to read the inside of the bottle top. They need to understand the rules. Let's have detailed consultations. Once we've taken the philosophical decision that we're not in a position where we have group taxation, that we've got entity-based system of tax, we're not allowing at this stage any interest deductions on loans to acquire shares. Let's look at the rules. Let's see where the abuse is. Let's see what is proposed, and let's try and draft legislation that will curb that abuse without also having the effect of catching unintended normal bona fide commercial transactions. And it's our concern that the process, and that might be a cost of democracy, but we think it's an avoidable cost in this case. The process in this case is too rushed. We're going into this. It was too rushed last year. It was too rushed the year before. And we're chasing our tail the whole time. Because we're going into this. We've introduced legislation. We've seen there's a gap. We tried to stop it by bringing in specific anti-avoidance legislation. We get 6 months into the act, and we say, oh, there are some other transactions that we're now identifying. We're going to try and stop them. And in the meantime, the transaction that we put in last year that we legislated against, that legislation is defective. We need to change that. And we're getting into this chasing our tail the whole time and trying to fix the legislation. And in the process, it becomes more and more difficult. And ironically, it lends itself to bigger abuse. Because what it does is ultimately it undermines taxpayer morality. I think in our view, in Deloitte's view, one of the great strides that have been made in the last 5, 6 years, 10 years in this country with by SARS is they have significantly moved to increasing taxpayer morality. I don't want to say that tax was ever perceived as a voluntary levy in this country. It wasn't that bad, the morality, but clearly we're moving into a system where people, they actually pay attention to what's stated in the Act, and they listen to what their tax advisors have to say about that. But they'll only prefer to listen to tax advisors where the laws are clear and the laws are certain. If the laws become unclear or uncertain, or they become ridiculous, then you are starting to undermine that taxpayer morality. And our fee really is to say, let's just stop this for a moment. Let's just catch our breath. Let's look at what we've got in the Act. If we're happy that this is the way that we're going at the moment, this is our system, let's look at the abuse that's been identified, and there will be other abuses that haven't been identified, and let's try and stop that with targeted anti-avoidance rules, if our general anti-avoidance rule is not good enough. And I say if, and we're saying we've spent 2 years trying to get a general anti-avoidance rule. I know I've made submissions and some of the other people here have made submissions when that rule was introduced.
because there was a feeling that the previous rule that we had was not good enough. At the time, a lot of the submissions that were made, people were saying, let's test the anti-avoidance rule and see whether it's good enough or not. But there was a feeling that our previous one was not good enough, so we've got a new one, which in layman's terms says that if you do something with a solar main purpose to avoid tax, and it's devoid of commercial substance, or it's got too many bells and whistles, we'll attack it. So we've got that. What we need now is it needs to be tested. We want SARS to have the courage of their conviction to take a case to court where they feel that there's been abuse and to test it in court. And so the way that what that will do is will develop precedent so that we don't sit here in 10 years' time and we start arguing about difficult and specific anti-avoidance rules are being introduced. But hopefully by that time we've developed a body of case law that will give us more precise guidance about what's possible and what's not possible. One of the problems that we've got in our tax system increasingly is that since 2001 we've moved from a source basis of tax where you only pay tax on South African source income to a residence-based system of tax where residents pay tax generally on all their worldwide income, non-residents pay on their South African source income, and capital gain tax was introduced. We've introduced a new system which is a world-class system. It's recognized internationally. When you deal with your clients in other countries, they understand the system. You can talk to them. So it's a great system, but we have not developed any body of case law, hardly any body of case law that tells us how to interpret contingent provisions. And what we need to start doing in this country is we need to see cases actually going to court so that we can develop that to make the system more of a principle-based system so that you can know what the principles are. You've got the principles, you can argue from those principles. The risk we're running is that we get rules upon rules upon rules. People forget about the intention of the legislature and they look at the rules and say, ah, there's a gap, I'll take that gap. Maybe it gets stuck in 3 months' time, but for the moment it's here, I'm going to take it. I think we need to move to a system where it becomes more principle-based and that the intention of government is clearly spelled out in the wording that's used in the Act. And that, I think, we believe is only possible if there's sufficient time given to look at legislation, sufficient time given to look at specific anti-avoidance provisions that are targeted for abusive transactions, and to get together with a technical experts, also in people that are working in private practice. The time for speculative, pure tax avoidance structuring, I think we all agree, is over. I know that Ethan, absolutely, from my dealings with him and our dealings with him, Treasury is bona fide, as far as a bona fide in the attempts to try and find a workable solution. On our part, we are bona fide in trying to get a system that works for the country. But we've got to be frank that there will be people that will try, there always will be people that will try and abuse the system. That's just the nature that's the human condition. That does not mean that we can't sit together and we can't try and thrash out legislation that works properly, that's well considered. The UK, it was mentioned this morning by David Lerma, the UK is looking at a participation exemption on dividends some of the CSC rules that they're looking at changing, the controlled foreign company rules. There's a discussion paper that was issued last year. It will take at least 2 years before the legislation is finalized and it comes into force. So there's a proper system of consultation, seeing what works, what won't work, where will there be unintended consequences. That is what we need in this country. We need that same system of proper consultation. And where something clearly is abusive, then let's use the GAR. Let's publish the transactions that you're worried about and say we'll go after that. But let's not rush in with legislation that creates the problems that this legislation is creating for us. Specifically around Section 45, which has been mentioned. We've submitted a submission document, and I'm not going to go through that in detail. I've spoken to the first three pages, the need for proper consultation, the need for period of consolidation, the use of the GAR and reportable arrangements. And then we get into specifics. But specifically around Section 45, which we discussed and which has been analyzed, A provision here in section 23, capital K, is on page 3 of our submission document, that proposes that where you buy, when a share, an equity share, comes into the country and it's purchased from a connected person, a non-resident, that you, it comes in at the lower, not at the market value, but at the lower base cost. Now, this provision runs completely contrary to anything that we've had to date in our legislation. It's contrary to the CEC rules. It says if a company becomes a controlled foreign company, it gets a step up in its base cost. It's contrary to the rule that says if you're a non-resident and you become a resident, you get a step up in your base cost to market value. We've had a provision in our Act not that long ago that says if an asset comes into the South African tax net, it comes in at market value. Yet we have this provision that completely goes the other way because it's there to stop the perceived abuse, but in the process goes much wider than that. So it's Section 23K, it's Section 45, it's also the Section 41 that's on page 4 of our submission document. That's the definition of a group of companies. What Treasury is clearly saying, and in principle one can understand that, is that one needs to, when it comes to providing relief in a group context, it's got to be to companies that act on the same tax plane. Now what they mean by that is, if you've got a non-resident that's not subject to such a South African capital gains tax, or not subject to the secondary tax on companies at this point, you can't have the same rules applying for asset transfers to that non-resident as what you would have to another South African resident, because that other South African resident is in the South African tax system, the non-resident is not in the tax system, and therefore you don't also want a position where you're starting discriminating against South African companies in that you can move assets out of the tax net without paying tax. It's David Lerma's point about we need to focus on the exit and the penalties being paid on exit or avoiding tax on exit and not paying anything for coming into the country. Our controlled foreign company regime basically says that if a company is owned more than 50% by South African residents, a foreign company, it's a controlled foreign company, and the income of that company must be imputed to the South African resident shareholders under certain circumstances. Those companies, as we see it, because they're controlled foreign companies, they are within the South African tax net to the extent that their income potentially fines should be taxed in South Africa in the hands of the South African resident shareholders, yet we exclude them from being a group of companies. To us, that doesn't make sense. We don't see the justification for that, and we'd like to see that revisited. Mr. Chair, we've got some smaller specific comments on page 6 of our submissions document, which I'm not going to run through now. Some of those issues have been dealt with, but they're there for members to look at. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's it. Let's take the next submission from Mr. Ed Liptek, Web Owens and Bowers. Maybe Mr. Russo, you should have actually just said here, so that because when we finish, we'll then take a discussion on both your submissions. Mr. Liptek, the floor is yours.
I'd like to thank the committee and its members for allowing us to make this presentation. And I would also, I think, at the outset, express my thanks and appreciation to Keith Engel and his staff, and also to the legislative policy people at SARS. I think in one sense, as you can tell, they certainly got our attention with this draft bill, but I think they've also gone out of their way to try to work with us within the short time frame on an honest, upfront, no-holds-barred kind of basis. And I, at this point, I'm cautiously optimistic that as painful as the process is going to be, at the end we'll have a nice, healthy baby boy. So, or girl. or both, but I'm not sure. I think there are a number of topics that I want to cover. The slide presentation is one of them, and I apologize because that's going to be, I think, more technical, I think probably a little bit more painful, like all tax issues. And I'm certainly willing, and I think Weber's and the South African Venture Capital Association are willing to donate whatever resources we can to help the committee, you know, both in this process or outside of it, in terms of trying to understand how the industry actually operates, how these transactions work, and what the tax implications are, good and bad. Because I think this is tough stuff. I think we all struggle with it, and we deal with it every day. And so if there are anything that we can do, we are willing to do it, because we think at the end of the day, the more consultation, the more collaboration, the better answer that we can get. I think the worst thing for everyone right now is to have a continuation of this process where we, SARS passes legislation, we find a loophole, we play some games, SARS finds out about it, they get out the shoe and they whack that little mosquito, does a lot of damage. We have this kind of fire drill. We come back next year, we find another loophole, and we do it again. I think there is absolutely no question in my mind that Section 45, as it is currently drafted, is an invitation to steal. It is radically overbroad. The GAR has put some limits on it, so it's not so much grand larceny anymore, but, you know, a little bit less. But it is fundamentally flawed legislation within the South African context, and it has to be addressed. It cannot be addressed effectively through the general anti-avoidance rule alone, because there are fundamental flaws within that structure. I think that there were some amendments last year that have helped to narrow some of those abuses. Where I agree fully with David Lammer, where I agree fully with LaRue, is that the problem, and I think it's not surprising given the way this process has, the relationship has developed over the years, is that it hits too broadly. My girlfriend makes fun of me because every so often in the middle of the night a mosquito will get in the room. And I will be there with a giant pillow trying to kill the thing, waking up our neighbors as they hit the walls and everything else. I think the... I think the feeling is there's another...
That must be investigated, because we must investigate whether she doesn't get bruised in the process.
I'm getting in more trouble than I thought. The reality is SARS is operating in the dark. I think as Franz came back with one of his pointed questions this morning, we do not volunteer what we are doing. We do everything possible when we have an aggressive scheme to try and keep it off of SARS's radar. We do not come forward. And I think that means when SARS finally does, in the dark, feel something out there and grabs onto it, they go for it. Then the lights come on and it turns out they've got a tiger, and then we're here trying to figure out how to let go of the tiger's tail without getting eaten. And so the one thing that I would say coming out of today is we have got to get a solution, and it is going to be damned hard to get there, where we allow legitimate transactions with economic substance to get through, and we stop this abuse once and for all. It is not going to be easy. I do not envy Keith and Franz and those folks their job, because it is going to be very, very hard. The other thing that I would say is do not be fooled when people come in and the first thing they say is BEE. because, yeah, sometimes I feel like I'm in a foreign film, because the characters on the screen are saying, BEE, 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 and then the subtitles come up, and it's millions of fees, millions of fees, millions of fees. The people who are using tax-driven schemes in connection with these BEE transactions are making millions at the expense of the fiscus. And that is never disclosed to Treasury. In many cases, what I have seen is that you have a viable BEE transaction on the table being done, and all of a sudden the vultures start circling. And somebody comes in and says, well, you know what, you're doing that deal, but we can save you 100 million rand. They don't tell you how. So we've got this black box. We're not going to tell you what's in it, but you sign all our papers, you pay our fee. And that black box involves a massive raid on the Treasury, and the tax savings get split between the people financing that deal and the people, not the BEE people, the company that is involved in making the BEE deal. So I think that is really what we are dealing with. To quote the old rock song by The Who, don't get fooled again. We cannot afford to let another Trojan horse in here at the end of this process, have all of these schemes come out of the belly in the middle of the night, rampage through the tax base, and then force Keith and Franz to come back here to this committee in a year with yet another round of emergency legislation. And I would say, based on my estimates, both when I was at SARS and now out in the private sector for the last 9 months, that we are talking about billions of permanent revenue loss a year since 2004, and I would say that permanent revenue loss probably ranges anywhere from 5 to 10 billion rand company tax, STC, CGT, income tax. That is permanent. That is gone. You are never going to get that back. So these, when Keith says these are big transactions, he is not exaggerating. And these schemes have been out there since 2004. SARS has come across them on audit. There have been other ones that you can kind of figure out from reading cautionary announcements. But I can tell you, in the entire time I was at SARS, never, and Keith, maybe you can tell me it was different at Treasury, but I certainly never saw a concerned practitioner or a concerned merchant banker come in and say, oh, you know what? We've got these legitimate transactions that are using these rules, but some people are abusing them, and you're losing a ton of money. It's a one-sided debate. And as a matter of fact, during the break, I had one person pull me aside and said, Ed, you can't say this. You know, you should leave it to SARS and National Treasury to say it. You can't have someone from our side breaking ranks. You know, I'm sorry, it's too important. And it is a process of legislation for the entire country to have this driven by special pleading, because I might be able to sell an avoidance scheme that's going to make me a 5 million rand bonus at the end of the year. It's not what I'm about. I've never agreed with Keith Engel that much in the entire 4 years I worked with him. let me move on. Keith, is that true or not? I would like to say at the outset that the issue of retrospectivity is also very important. In the business context, these transactions take months to put into place, from the initial negotiations through the due diligence that you have to do. You know, if you're going to buy a car, you want to kick the tires, you want to ride it around the block a couple of times, you want to see that everything's okay. That process typically takes anywhere from 6 weeks to 2 months. There are follow-up questions. Then you've got to arrange the financing. Then you got to spend 2 months haggling about the price and arguing back and forth. But once you get a signed agreement after that 3 or 4 month lead up, then you have a series of regulatory hurdles that you have to jump through. As the parties to the deal, you're basically locked in, provided that the Reserve Bank, the Competitions Commission, any of the other regulatory agencies give their approval. Now, if the parties have gotten this far down the road, they typically are fairly certain they are going to get those approvals. But it takes time. What is happening with the way these laws are being proposed in terms of effective dates, I actually have a client in this situation. They started negotiating their deal in August. They were hoping to close in May. They have been standing on the window ledge waiting for me to give them a cell phone call at the end of this meeting, because if those laws are made applicable to this transaction, basically the entire thing falls apart, and there are going to be lawsuits all over the place, because you've got firm commitments for financing, you've got binding agreements, you've got breakup fees in the event that the deal doesn't go through. These deals reach a certain stage. For listed companies, it's called the firm intent stage, where you're basically saying, absent a hurricane, tsunami, or lightning bolt, we are going to do this deal. From that point, you can still take, you know, local practice better than I do, but can still take 2 to 3 to 4 months. Having an effective date like this throws a transaction that's been negotiated and is simply waiting final regulatory approval into absolute chaos. I mean, I have one situation in which the client had put together the financing for their deal. These new rules would hit them with an extra tax liability up front that would leave them with a 500 million rand gap in their financing. They are immediately in default on their loan agreement. No one's ever had a situation like this before. We do not know what to do if this happens. And so the one thing that I would say is, we understand that there are emergencies. We understand that SARS is always behind the curve in terms of what the aggressive players in the market are doing. But there has to be a balance. And for those taxpayers who have relied on the rules as they are written, they're not transactions that could be attacked under the GAR, that you have to consider some relief for those transactions that have reached the firm intent stage. In terms of some of the questions that came up yesterday, you know, sort of talked about how is Section 45 actually used in practice. And I think that there are really three areas where it's used. And one is on basic routine intergroup reorganizations. The other is in the merger and acquisition context. And then the third is in the abusive transaction structured finance area. The routine transactions are basically, you've got a group of companies. As time goes on, you know, the company kind of grows. You realize that you've got three different subsidiaries. They're all doing aspects of the same thing. And so you say, look, let's just consolidate them in one company. 45 allows you to do that with no tax consequence. You know, sometimes you simply have one asset that you were using in one part of your business, and you realize, you know what, we need to use that over here. And you move just that one asset. Those were the intended transactions. That's actually worked, I think, to date without any problem. My sense is that those transactions probably account for less than half of the Section 45 transactions that actually happen in the marketplace. They happen, but they're fairly routine. Typically, they're not huge values. Sometimes they are. The second set of transactions are merger and acquisition transactions, and this is where that whole notion of push-down debt arrangements come in. Now, I would say that, it's very difficult to come up with hard numbers. I would say that probably somewhere between 30 and 50% of your Section 45 transactions right now are part of these merger and acquisition push-down debt arrangements. I would say the flip side, which might be the more important element, is that I would think in any one of your major business acquisition situations in which the acquirer is borrowing money to buy the target, that you will be using a Section 45 debt push-down arrangement to make that transaction economically feasible. And then I would think the third area are the abusive transactions. And I think in that area you probably have two major categories at this point, probably some subsets within that. I mean, these things are like drug-resistant bacteria. You know, you come up with the cure, you come up with the antibiotic, you barely got it out there, and they've mutated again, and you're back. I mean, it is an uphill struggle. But I think one set, and I think it's the one that Keith and his team, I think, identified very clearly in the media release, is something that's called a disguised sale. You're taking something that's supposed to defer taxation to a later date. What you're actually doing is playing with the rules to get rid of that tax for forever. There's a second set of abusive transactions, much more complex, and I think in some ways much more dangerous, that involve turning groups of companies into conduits, empty tubes, so that you can flow cash right through them with absolutely no tax consequence. You know, when we had that long guard debate, we talked about round-trip financing arrangements where all you do is move money around in the circle. Nobody pays tax, but somebody gets two deductions at the end of the day. People are using Section 45 for that purpose, and the revenue loss there is enormous. And again, it's permanent. Okay. Well, so if I could very, very quickly then, I think, do I have 2 minutes, 1 minute? Five. I mean, I know I'm boring, but no one's ever done that before. we're dealing with a multiple set of problems, unfortunately. I think we are starting off with a tax system that's fundamentally flawed because it doesn't deal with modern tax and economic realities. We're still stuck in a very old-fashioned system. That was recognized during the GAR debate. I think there was a recognition that we need to move towards group taxation, an explicit recognition that we need to deal with the fact that under current rules, interest expense incurred in acquiring 100% of the shares of another business is non-deductible. That's simply the wrong answer. It is contrary to international tax norms. It doesn't make any sense. It results in the double taxation of economic income if you've got domestic lenders. It's something that I think is on the agenda. The problem is it is a big change. It's a complicated change, and it's going to take time. I think what we have had to date that has kept the system from blowing up is the push-down debt arrangement under Section 45 that allows people to get to the exact same result they would be under international tax norms in these transactions. No more, no less. And so it's a stopgap. It's a safety valve until we can get the basic rules into shape, into where they ought to be. Once we can do that, then these problems should fall away. But right now we have a system, I mean, I joked with someone once that, you know, our tax system is kind of, you know, something where, you know, kind of all the negatives cancel out. At the end of the day, it kind of works. If you take 45 away, you're taking half of those negatives out of the picture, and the thing is just going to fall over. I mean, so that until the interest expense deduction issue is resolved explicitly, you need to maintain a stopgap that deals with this in modifying 45 to ensure that that safety valve remains open. At the same time, you cannot let these abusive schemes back in through the back door. Otherwise, we're going to be back here. And I know you don't want me back here. Again, I would like to very much thank the committee. I would like to thank Keith and his team for the efforts that they've made. If I could say one last thing, it's that part of the problem is that South Africa is asking Keith and his team to do far too much with far too few resources. I know we all struggle with the skill shortage. I know there are a million issues on the table, but I can tell you that the South African resources here are less than 10% of what you would have in other countries dealing with comparable issues. It simply cannot be done. Just one anecdote, we had an international advisor from the OECD in Azores on a Saturday morning. There were eight of us sitting around the room. We were talking about an issue. Guy from the OECD gets all excited. He goes, well, first thing you get your team to do this, and then your team does that, and blah, 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 blah. And so I raised my hand and I said, Rick, this is the team. And he stopped and didn't know what to say. And four of those eight people had other significant responsibilities besides legislative drafting. You need more horsepower. Or it's not going to work. Thank you.
Yeah. Keith, I know you don't belong to any trade union, but don't put the shop steward. Okay, we've had the truth. We've had Deloitte. We've had Mr. Leptek from Weber, Wenzel, Barnes. Let's engage. Mr. Mgune, Dr. George, Mr. Mlodlo, go ahead.
Thank you. I said any submission or admission of guilt by any presenter since the Fire Act, or the new Fire Act. I just want to find out from Deloitte and Touch, George, about Section 45. Elle said, no, we're chasing our take. But you know exactly that in order to stop that, actually you practicing us. You are the ones who was time and again inventing these, what they call, as I call the washing machines. You know, as you put it, you know there's a gap there, and you go for the gap, you end up not making these group companies of which you, as it says, is a conscience for all the feed, all the money that is actually just good to there. How can you propose that you stop it? As Section 45, according to him in his submission, he said it's a good a stop valve to stop all these illegal transactions. But I just want to know from you, as practitioners, how do you intend to stop all these washing machines that are in a proper manner? And secondly, on the issue of these BE transactions, what do you think should be put in place in order for the practitioners and also companies to prevent them from avoiding tax? What do you think is a proper measure without some practitioners now saying we actually bogging our tax system? Because it's a retrospective tax system that we're practicing now. But what do you think we should put in place that would be progressive?
Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. For Deloitte, Mr. Rulop, so you say on the second page of the submission from Deloitte, you mentioned that a large number of clients will have placed transactions on hold because of the latest proposal. Will they find another way to achieve these objectives? And if not, what are the potential consequences for them? And then Mr. Liptak, in the submission from Weber Wenzel Bowens, it mentions that Section 45 would have has been misused and abused, and it goes on to say that the proposed amendments in their current form would have a devastating impact on the merger and acquisition activity in South Africa. Which is the lesser evil, or is it impossible to determine? And a very short answer would be appreciated. Thank you.
So Weber Wenzel, I've got some few questions. My first question is, you know, I hear your argument. You're saying that on page 3 about the issue of deduction of interest.
On page
3
of your submission, not the PowerPoint.
Yes, at the bottom.
Have you got a copy of that?
Okay, let me just read the sentence. No, let me read the sentence. You say the basic rule in South Africa is that interest is expense incurred in connection with the acquisition of shares is not deductible because the return on those shares dividends is exempt from tax and therefore not included in the definition of income under current law. In general, the reasoning goes, expense can only be deducted to extent that they are incurred in the production of income. Okay, let me just stop there. I read an article, I think it was in The Economist, where they were saying there's a general concern internationally about some of these transactions where a lot of debt is being used to acquire them, and there's interest deduction to the point that it erodes the tax base. What's your view on that? Because you're saying part of... I hear you, but I'm not understanding you quite well. You say some of these problems will be solved by us moving to the issue of group taxation. Can you clarify that more? The other point, Chair, it's... I'm mixing up my stuff. The other point is on the push down, the debt push down that you're talking about. In the submission of the Chair, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Stuff
all over.
Take your time. When you're 80, this is
different. Yeah, I can see my head. My head is receding and thinning out. In the submission, the issue of the intergroup push down debt. I'm not sure. Can you explain to me what your concerns about this whole issue is about? Because the point that I understood initially from SARS is that we should avoid a situation where a company which enjoys certain reliefs, but to push down those reliefs down to other subsidiaries. So what's your concern about that? And my last point, Chair, I think to deal with and push. In your submission, you have a proposal of, if I'm still recalling, I can't see my document, of 18 months to try to solve the issue of Section 45. If I'm correct, if I can locate my document here. Yeah, you say to help address this mischief with which SARS is concerned, we recommend that the legislation rather provide that if an unbundled share is disposed of within 18 months after the unbundling to a buyer outside the group of companies of which the unbundled company is a member, then the base cost of the unbundled share will be equal to the base cost which that unbundled share had in the hands of the unbundled company immediately before the unbundling occurred. So in your view, say you think that the issue of insertion of the 18 months would solve the problem.
In any order, whoever wants to respond first, you're welcome.
I think a lot of the questions overlap, or the answers to the questions overlap, so I'll go first and then if you can fill in where there are gaps. On the question of Section 45 and the abuse that one encounters, it's important to bear in mind that when it comes to the application of tax law, there are a number of principles. One is that each person is allowed to arrange his or her affairs to pay the least amount of tax possible within the confines of the law. Nobody is disputing that. So one can, if one's going to do a business transaction, you can legitimately look at the options available to you, and there's nothing wrong with saying, I'm going to go for option A because it gives me a better result than option B. That's not in dispute. The second thing is there's an old rule, and it's still a rule, is that there's no equity about tax, as it was said in one of our court cases. You look clearly at what the legislation says, you try to discern the intention of the legislature, and you apply the ordinary wording, the meaning of the words in the legislation within the context of the Act as a whole. That said, specifically when you deal with and you would only deviate from that if the answer would lead to a glaring absurdity, which the legislature could never have intended. And in the context of an avoidance rule, like the general anti-avoidance rule, you can adopt a purposive approach. In other words, you can go beyond maybe the ordinary meaning of the words in order to suppress the mischief against which the legislation is directed. Those are important basic principles to bear in mind. A third point is that where there is an ambiguity in the legislation, one adopts a contra-fiscum approach. In other words, you will go, if it's not clear what the act is, you can interpret it one of two ways. The taxpayer is within his rights to take the approach that is most favorable to him or her. And those principles one would apply to each and every transaction. So in the context of Section 45 and the abuse, I would, if a client comes to me and he asks me that he wants to do this transaction, I would consider the possible options available to him. I would look at Section 45. I would look at the opportunities that are provided there to structure the transaction. And in interpreting that, I would be applying these principles that you can minimize your tax burden. You can, if there's an ambiguity, you can interpret it in your favor. If it's a specific anti-avoidance rule that's in there, be aware that the legislature can interpret that to suppress the mischief in a purposive manner. But there's no obligation on me to go for the option that gives the most tax. And there's an override to all these, and that's what the general anti-avoidance rule is. If I do something which has got no commercial substance, and which has got its sole or main purpose to avoid tax, then it can be caught irrespective from any specific anti-avoidance rules. What that requires of taxpayers and tax advisors is to be intellectually honest when they look at legislation. They've got to look at it fairly and say, if I'm intellectually honest here and I put an interpretation on this, what is the legislature intending here? And do the words here support that intention? Now the legislation tells you, you've got to look at the legislation to discern the intention of the legislature. The explanatory memorandum is a very nice document, and it helps you to read that story before you go read the detailed legalese of the legislation to understand what the legislature is all about. But it's in the EM, it is said A, but the Act is written so that it says B. One's got to follow the Act, so that it, because the Act is what governs. And it happens from time to time quite frequently, that we would look at legislation and say, oh, this is not in line with what the explanatory memorandum says. And often there's a process of going to SARS, interacting with them, saying we've run up against this problem because your explanatory memorandum is not in line with what the Act says. Please clarify that this is not what you intended. And you will often find when you go through amending legislation that there are technical corrections or there are specific provisions introduced to make it clear, to give effect to the legislature's intention. But absent those actions on the part of the legislature, there's not much one can do but to follow the Act unless it leads to a glaring absurdity. By the same token, if there are glaring loopholes or the legislature intention isn't clear, taxpayers will look at it and say, well, it's not entirely clear what the position is here, what the intention is, and taxpayers will try and exploit that loophole, or they will go for the result that gives them the best answer. Always bearing in mind that as soon as you do something that's abusive, as soon as you do something that's got a pure tax avoidance purpose, it can be struck down under the GAR, and it's always open to start, if they don't like this particular result, to come back and to say, we're going to introduce a specific anti-avoidance provision for predominantly running to the bar to fix that. So to answer your question, one cannot legislate against taxpayer behavior. You can't force people not to try and interpret the legislation in a way that is, let's call it intellectually dishonest. That's always going to be there. That is why what we're saying is we're laying stress on the fact that that's why we need clear legislation that is there to, that fosters and enhances taxpayer morality so that you know that this is clear, there can be no room for argument here, and if you choose to take an opinion which clearly is way from left field and is not sustainable, you're going to be punished. And that's the best one can do. You're always going to have this situation where you've got an Income Tax Act or a Value-Added Tax Act or any other tax act where people's funds are expropriated, you're always going to have your honest advisors and you're going to have your more aggressive advisors. And what we should try and do is to stamp out, as Ed's been saying, we should stamp out the clearly abusive transactions in a manner that does not impinge on the honest transactions. The question on what we will do...
Can I request that we be concise in our responses?
Yeah. I think hopefully that also answers, to a degree, maybe some of the other questions. The question is on the 18-month rule that was asked about how do we make a proposal in terms of holding shares for 18 months so that you can get a step up in your base cost. We're getting into very technical legislation. Essentially, what we're proposing is that if a lot of the corporate rules allows restructures, but then within an 18-month period, you're not allowed to sell assets, or you may sell assets, or you may do other transactions, but the benefits of the tax relief that was provided are unwound. And the proposal there around the 18 months is to say that if you want to bring in something that gives you a lower base cost, have it the same as what you have for a lot of the other rules in there. Have it for an 18-month period that would be consistent with what you've got elsewhere. And then after, if you haven't sold it within 18 months, probably isn't a tax avoidance structure, and then you revert to having a normal set of base cost. I think, does that answer my questions?
I think first with respect to the BEE transactions, I think there are a number of questions there. I think the goal would be to modify the proposed amendments to Section 45 again in a way that stops the abusive transactions and permits the BEE transactions to go forward on a commercially sound basis. I think it does raise a broader question in terms of whether or not there should be specific incentives for BEE transactions. And I know that is a contentious issue. And my understanding is that in general the policy has been that should not be the case. I know Treasury has been extremely good in the last couple of years in removing unintended tax hurdles in the face of BEE transactions so that they're easier to implement and that there aren't these hidden gotchas. But beyond that, it seems to me that what you want to have is a system where whatever the final rules are, they don't create any new unintended hurdles for these legitimate transactions. I think one thing to keep in mind is that these avoidance schemes that typically cost Treasury hundreds of millions of rands in lost revenue, very little of that actually ever sees its way to the BEE partner. A huge portion of it goes to the people providing the finance, a good chunk goes to the lawyers, accountants, and investment advisors, and another big chunk goes to the company that's setting up the scheme. And again, it's complicated, so I'd be happy to walk through the mechanics of what some of these transactions actually look like and who gets what at the end of the day. But if you're going to spend hundreds of millions of rand to facilitate BEE deals, I mean, to me, it makes more sense to give it to the BEE participants than to the lawyers, accountants, financial advisors, and banks who are sitting around the table. In most of these transactions, when the shares are actually given on day one to the BEE partners, they have virtually no economic value. And it's not until 10 years down the road that those shares may or may not have any value. So, I couldn't think of the word. In terms of...
Do you classify this intellectual honesty?
that or career suicide, but... What are you going to do? Barack Obama has convinced me we're in a new age of hope. And so, it's got to happen. on the Section 45 question in terms of misuse or abuse versus nuking the economy overall, I don't think it's an either-or question. I do think that if these proposals are enacted in their current form, you will have a devastating impact on deal transaction right now. My guess is it will take at least 6 to 12 months for those changes to work themselves out. But right now, every deal that I am aware of, whether it's private equity, normal mergers and acquisitions, simple cross-border investment into South Africa, they are on hold. They do not know what to do. And a number of these deals that make economic sense right now, if you can get a deduction solely for the actual economic interest expense that you are incurring to buy that business, those deals will fall apart if the legislation isn't changed to protect this debt push-down safety valve. And I think that is going to be... I think it was a very, very bad development for the economy. I know there was a famous economist once who was arguing with a politician, and the politician was saying, yeah, but in the long run, X, Y, and Z will happen. And the economist basically said, look, in the long run, we're all going to be dead. I mean, in the long run, this will sort itself out, and the market will reprice everything to take into account the tax. But it is going to be painful while you're living through it. We ran some numbers on some of our transactions. The changed rules will essentially add an additional upfront tax burden of about 10 to 15% per transaction. We translated that into share price on the offers. In one case, the original bid was 30 rand per share. The impact of these tax amendments would take it down to 25 and a half. Another one was 25, it took it down to 22.5. That's an immediate upfront cash hit. You know, Keith and I and folks talk about the deferral regime, and there are a couple of different reasons why you defer tax. And one of them is you want to encourage genuine economic business activity, various kinds of mergers, because they make economic sense. They make the economy grow faster. If you throw a huge tax burden in there up front, those deals just don't become feasible anymore. It's too much of an upfront cash hit at a point where the company is just too new, struggling to get on its feet, trying to go forward. That's why you defer. You give up tax now to get a much bigger tax later, and hopefully in the process you're creating jobs and doing all those other good things. So... in terms of lesser evil, I don't know. but I think the right answer, and I'm confident that Keith is going to work with us to avoid that choice between two, I think, completely disastrous choices. I think the last questions were just on debt pushdown and interest. Just to very quickly clarify, I think that, like everything else, there's not an easy answer. And I think what other countries have found is that because these transactions really are business transactions, that interest expense should be deductible. Then comes the big but. There has to be limits, reasonable limits, on how much interest can be deducted. I lived through the 1980s in America, where we came up with the original round of leveraged buyouts. And you'd have people borrowing $99 million from the banks, putting in $1 million of their own to buy a company. That's why they call them junk bonds. Your risk of default was so high, the bonds were basically junk. Those were incredibly highly risky. They were bad for the economy. It led the U.S. right into a recession. People have gotten a lot smarter since then. But I think what's important to emphasize is that the current round of transactions that are happening are nothing like that. Most of the transactions that you're seeing in the private equity area, you are probably talking about 50% debt, 50% equity, or 60% debt, 40% equity. You almost never get above 70% debt. So you're talking about, you know, 1-to-1, 2-to-1, not 99-to-1, like you did in the old LBO transactions. The other thing in terms of the economic model, in the old LBOs, the whole idea was you take over the company and then you would cut it up, sell off the pieces, downsize your workforce, and do all of that to pay off the debt. Then you'd resell the country and make a profit. I've been involved in a lot of these private equity deals now. It is a different model, and you've got a different class of people behind them. They are in these deals for the long haul. I have not seen a single business model that talks about we're going to sell off that plant or we're going to lay off those workers to cut costs. It is a growth model. We see growth potential in this company. That is why we are investing, and we think we can make this company grow, and this is a good investment. And they are not thinly capitalized. There's not excessive interest expense. These are good business deals, and I think if you look at the statistics internationally, these kind of transactions have actually performed better than some of the traditional listed companies. They grow faster, they create more jobs, they bring skills into the country. I mean, I can go on and on about this. So I was not a true believer when I started working in this area. But I think with proper safeguards around the outside, you can protect against that concern about overly highly leveraged deals, too much interest expense, too much risk of downsizing, and get to the right answer. It's a question of balance, and I think that's what a lot of other countries have been able to get to. We can, I think, leverage off their experience.
Okay, in the last few minutes, again, the same exercise. Is there any clarities and areas where National Treasury staffs would want to...
Yeah, try not to be too emotional. I didn't run last night, so I had a little extra emotion in the earlier shot. Let me just say three quick points. First thing is about the issue that was raised, the tax is not about equity. Law is an expression of the people's will. And it is about equity. It is about fairness. The tax system, especially the income tax system, is making sure that the richer people pay a larger share. Especially in the society that we have today, it is definitely an issue of fairness. Unfortunately, the legal climate is such that they don't emphasize the issue of fairness. They emphasize literalism. And what we're trying to do is make sure that we have fairness in the system. Second issue. I do think that we need to find a middle way here. I don't think it should be a black-white contrast where we have a choice of total destruction or total freedom. But in order to get to that goal, we have to be very specific about the examples that we're talking about. Unfortunately, tax is tedious, and it's very specific. In some of the submissions that I've received, people have been very specific about the good and the bad. That has been helpful. But still, all too often, many of these submissions, there's lots of law and then there's emotion. We need to get specific information so we're getting around with what Edward said is about groping in the dark. To the extent we have real facts, we will respond accordingly.
final point is I just do appreciate the support about myself and my team. I have to say Jean and Mark are wonderful. I have other very good members of the team, and I also have to say that we would not be able to accomplish any of this without SARS. So that's just a short note, and I will cut it off at that.
Thank you, Chair. Just a very brief comment. I mean, a lot of emphasis has been placed on the Guard during the course of this morning. I'd just like to point something out, which is that the GAR came into effect, the new GAR, on the 2nd November 2006. And we can expect to start applying that GAR in full force once the returns that relate to that period forward start coming into SARS. Now, given that there are significant extensions for many of these returns, you can first see the first problem that we have. Now, we do have a reportable arrangements system, which is going to be expanded. That will be coming into force in the not-too-distant future, which will hopefully give us advance notice. But again, applying the GAR can only occur once the return is in place. Second point is about SARS taking matters to court. Let me give you a practical example. Back in 2004, you may be aware, for those of you who are around, for those of you who are not, I'll tell you about it, of a certain FTC structure, which an argument which was put before us. It essentially was argued to allow people to take dividends out of the country to their foreign holding companies without having to pay FTC. The minister made an announcement about steps that would be taken to counter that on the 26th of August 2004. We simultaneously proceeded to brief senior counsel to take this matter to court. The test case that we were dealing with was finally settled fairly recently, with the taxpayer conceding the matter in full to us. Now, we don't have a court case on this matter. There are other taxpayers that wish to proceed with it, but we're going to have to now take them to court. So I suspect that for a matter which was brought into the public domain in 2004, it'll probably be 2009 before we see a court case emerging from it. So here again is a practical issue with an absolute reliance on the GAR. It is going to be a long process because it is going to be driven through the court system and it is dependent on tax returns coming in that we can apply the GAR to. I'm not sure that I'd clarify that particular issue.
Okay. Without necessarily preempting the meeting that you are going to be having, I would want to say that I trust that some of the matters that are being contested here are going to be clarified in that meeting, and that when we get responses next week, we are going to be in a position as the committee to have an informed view of the situation and then be able to take the process forward. But it actually is one of those processes that unfortunately have to happen in this, under these time pressures, and we'll all appreciate that, you know, there just is no way that we could have a 48-hour day. The days will remain 24 hours, and as long as that's the situation, and as long as Parliament sits for 32 weeks in a year, we'll forever be confronted with this, but we'll try our best to see how best we can accommodate situations like this. But we look forward to next week's responses, and we trust that this meeting that is planned is going to deal with this. You know, the issue of mergers, acquisitions, and BE transactions. I have just received a tip from members that we would really, as this committee, need a full session on those, because we need a fuller understanding into the workings of these transactions. So you were not as boring as you thought you were. You might find yourself with other players also being invited, just to be able to, away from the environment of taxation law and amendment, just looking at these transactions in order for the committee to have a full understanding of what takes place there. Okay, that then brings us to the end of this session. We meet again on Friday, where we're going to take a briefing on the widely publicized report of State SA on Income and Expenditure Survey. An interesting one indeed. But we meet again on Friday at 9 o'clock. And the responses to this will be next week, Wednesday, the 12th. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you all. Thanks for coming. Thanks for the time you've taken to enrich the process. Thank you. Thank you.